Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Marina Duncherski. I'm a Bruin of class of 1994 and the author of the recently released UCLA The First Century, a book that was 8 years in the making, sponsored by the UCLA Alumni Association, Gold Shield, and supported by Amundsen Foundation. I'm here with Anne Reber-Puzzle, proud Bruin, class of 1967, who has a real rich legacy with UCLA. Welcome, Anne.
Thank you, Marina. I'm pleased to be with you.
It's great to have you here. I'm delighted to be able to talk with you about UCLA history. Now, you have a long connection with UCLA, beginning in your family, beginning with your great-grandfather, who we know as the namesake of Reber Hall. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
Well, of course, in my family, he was known as Foddy, which was everybody's grandfather, although he was my great-grandfather. He was the son of German immigrants. He was born in Placerville, California, during the time of the Gold Rush. His parents were innkeepers. And I find it amazing that somehow he managed to make his way to Harvard to earn his Ph.D. in philosophy, studying with Josiah Royce and William James, among others. And, of course, he was the first dean of the College of Letters and Science at what we now call UCLA, but what at that time was determined to be the Southern Branch.
Of course, and he was dean from 1923 to 1936, correct?
Correct. And, of course, since the campus was new and the enrollment was not that large, he was also a beloved professor of philosophy. And he very much enjoyed teaching courses in logic as well as the history of philosophy and the philosophy of religion. And although I don't have any memory of him, I have many longtime Bruins who've told me of their fond memories of his classes.
And didn't he influence Ralph Bunche?
Yes. One of the things that Dean Reber did, he had a box of little cardboards. In those days, shredded wheat came in a cardboard box, and the different little parts were separated by these 4 by 8 inch sheets of cardboard. And being a frugal sort, he saved all of those and wrote pithy quotes and sayings on them and kept a box of them in his office. And when Ralph Bunche was chosen to be the graduation speaker for his class, he went to Dean Reber for advice and for other subjects as well, always turned to that wonderful box of shredded wheat cardboards. It was sort of the Wikipedia of its time. And another another student that he greatly influenced was Agnes DeMille. And she, he not only taught wonderful classes, but he became close friends and mentors for his students. And he's very beloved to this day for those who have remembered him.
Yes, and one of my favorite stories of Dean Reber was about his stationery. And when UCLA, as you mentioned, was called the Southern Branch, students in the Daily Bruin first tagged UCLA as UCLA and were pushing to get a more identifiable name for the University of California, UCLA. And he printed stationery with those four emblematic letters. And when Berkeley found out about it, the officials called him, of course, and soundly scolded him. And his classic response was simply to print more of it. And I know that was one of the stories that you and I talked about long ago when I interviewed you for the book.
Definitely.
Do you have other favorite stories of him?
Well, one of the ones that I have been thinking about very much in the last 10 minutes is that he absolutely hated the telephone. He was a very independent idealist, and he would start talking on a topic, and he did not want to be interrupted. And one time he was having a conference in his office, and I guess his secretary had stepped out for a moment, and the phone started to ring, and he was so irate that he just went and pulled the phone wire right out of the wall, dumped the phone in the trash basket, and went back to the conversation. So he did have his ego, and he did have his very independent spirit. But I'm sure that came from his background growing up in the wilds of the California Sierra. One of my other favorites that you found is when they opened the campus at Westwood in September of 1929, there was loads of mud and construction was not completely complete, and he wanted very much to encourage the students. So he suggested that there be two courses, one in whistling and another new course in nettle grasping. And, of course, now when you look at those aerial photographs of what the campus looked like when they first moved in, you could see why you needed whistling and nettle grasping to make it through the muddy fields.
It really is amazing to see those aerials, particularly in 1929 one, where you see the four buildings and there's absolutely nothing around it but the rolling hills and farmland. And one of my favorite quotes in the book, and something that I've kept since I was a student, I received this clipping as a graduation present in 1994, was an unidentified newspaper that said that UCLA was so far in the country that only farmers would ever be the students' neighbors. And it's just so funny to think of that today.
And when you look at the hills, there aren't any trees on them either. It's just sort of roaming farmland. And incidentally, Dean Reber and his wife chose to live in Pacific Palisades, which was even further away from the center of Los Angeles. And they had a lovely home up in the Palisades Riviera, and the mailbox said Dr. Reber on it. And one night there was a frantic knocking on the door, and a neighbor came to say, "Dr. Reber, Dr. Reber, my wife's having a baby. You have to come and help us." So Dean Reber, Dr. Reber, went next door and helped deliver the baby. And once the family doctor had arrived, coming many miles to this, he made sure everything was well. But he did remind his neighbor that next time he'd probably like to know that his neighbor was a doctor of philosophy and not medicine.
Not quite his job description.
Well, so all went well, but he had a wonderful quote that he said, no philosopher since Plato would ever admit there was a subject that he didn't know something about. So I guess
great.
That covers delivering babies as well.
Well, you know, his spirit really reminds me of the similar spirit that so many UCLA leaders have had over the years, and the whole identity of UCLA as being a university built on risk. From the struggles to found campus in the early part of the century, beginning in 1913, and finally being founded in 1919, through more recent decades. And, of course, you were on campus in the 60s. Tell us a bit about being on campus during the 60s again.
Well, it was a pretty exciting time to be there. But I can't imagine that any time at UCLA isn't an exciting time to be there. We started in the early 60s. We were complete idealists. The Peace Corps had begun. We felt we were pretty much the center of the world, and we were going to be leading great, wonderful projects that would save humanity. And as the 60s went along, we were crushed by, while I was a student, there were those three assassinations, John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and then Bobby Kennedy. And that was quite devastating for the youth of that time. And I think even though our 60s started out with great idealism, we were sort of hit by many different projects and problems and incidents that I remember to this day. In fact, although I had started as a commuter, I did pledge a sorority because that was the only way that I could live on campus. And the first semester, my roommate was selected to be the homecoming queen. And yet that homecoming was the week of the assassination of JFK. And that was really a rude interruption in our lives and just a an amazing abruptness to make us look at the world in a different way.
Of course, that was a moment where so many people remember exactly where they were and what they were doing. And at UCLA, students had been planning for that homecoming parade. And, of course, it was canceled. And there's a great photograph with the Daily Bruin lying with the headline of Kennedy assassinated lying among the remnants of that parade.
I know. And I still, to this day, am in touch with my friend. I sat right next to her in my Anthro 1 class in Dodd Hall. And it's true. You just remember precisely the moment when that announcement came. And an interesting thing happened when we found out that the president had been killed. Several of the sorority sisters went back and for lunch, and there were three of them that hadn't been, they'd been sleeping late and bothered by other things. And the first person that we went in and said, "Melinda, the president's been killed," and she immediately thought, since she had been the past president, that we were talking of the president of the sorority. She said, "Oh, no, Carol." And the second person that we went to get up and make this announcement, we said, "Robin, the president has been killed." And she, having been very active in student body government, thought it was the president of the student body. But no one ever in her full mind would ever think that the president of our country could be shot and killed so easily and quickly. So it was a real shock.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, more turbulent times followed. Do you remember some of those on campus?
I would say the more turbulent times came in the later 60s when, and really into the 70s. But yes, there were another interesting thing that happened at the sorority at that time. You had to sign in and sign out in a box with index cards. And so if you were going to leave and not be home in time for dinner, you had to say where you were going and with whom you were going and when you would be back. So one of my favorite memories is my sorority sisters with sleeping bags under their arms, following the rules of the sorority and carefully signing out that they were going to be spending the night at the administration building because they were protesting the bombing in Cambodia. And mm-hmm. I thought it was so interesting to see that we'd gone from the rules and regulations of the sorority to a protest and the kind of civil disobedience that followed in the next decade.
Yeah, UCLA is interesting in that respect, in that the 60s were more conservative and more quiet, and while Berkeley was going through the free speech movement, that picked up a little bit at UCLA, but not as much. But the 70s and the late 60s, starting probably in about 68, on through the 70s, were really UCLA's decade of protest.
Oh,
and, of course, the Vietnam War and anti-draft movement and so much of that, even leading to an unprecedented campus shutdown after the Kent State shootings when several students were killed by National Guardsmen. It's difficult. I can hardly believe, you know, the university being in such a tumultuous time, if you think about it today.
Well, it really was tumultuous. And we still believed in discussion and sharing of ideas. We would have remarkable conferences and discussions among ourselves. There were many on the faculty that led us in these discussions. I don't think we'd really gotten to the level of the protests in Berkeley, but it didn't mean that we weren't involved in these ideas and concerned about our future and the future of our country. So a lot did go on, and there was the constant cloud of the draft. I don't think students today really understand how every young man had his draft card and had a number, and you had to stay in school and have a certain number of units to keep your student deferment. And then the country changed its rules, and you could not get a deferment if you were a graduate student. So, and students would try and lengthen their undergraduate stay, if possible, to avoid the draft. And others faced the draft in different ways and did leave. And fortunately for me, my friends did all come back. But it was very much a cloud above all of our ideas. And because we knew our friends and classmates were involved, I think we knew a lot more about what was going on and were more willing to protest such a war.
I understand that we have a caller on the line, Anne, with a question for you.
Thank you.
Hello, are you there? Well, maybe not quite yet. The question I'm told, Anne, is, how much did it cost for you to go to UCLA when you were a student?
It's interesting. I don't remember precisely because when I started, it was per semester, and then my senior year, they switched to quarters, which was a rude interruption. But it was less than $100 a semester in terms of student fees, and nobody even called it tuition then.
Mm-hmm.
And for most of us, many of us, students lived at home and commuted to campus. So it was not an expensive adventure. We were very blessed. And I've always felt that since I essentially received a scholarship from the state of California for my education, that I feel an obligation to give to scholarships for future UCLA students who don't currently have the benefit of such an inexpensive education.
Mm-hmm. And of course, the premise of tuition-free has been something that was fundamental to the creation of the University of California and the Master Plan of Higher Education during Clark Kerr's time. And that was recently changed as the dynamics of the state and everything is changing, and finally the word tuition was adopted as something that students are now paying.
Well, I think it's at least an honest description of what we're now having our students pay.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting. Over the years, students have always protested many things, and of course fees have been one of them. One thing I found surprising was that in earlier times as well, they were also understanding that situations were difficult. And one remarkable time was during the time of Governor Dick Majan and President Gardner. And I remember that there had been terrible budget years. And then all of a sudden, the president and the governor had worked together and installed a one-year 30% increase to the budget of the University of California and sort of helped put the institution back where it was. Do you remember reading about that, Anne?
Well, it was after my time, but I mean, as a student, but yes, living here, I was certainly aware of it. And I think it was the right view that we need to support an inexpensive way for students to obtain a college degree. And as things have, and even now, for the students with a very low income, financial aid is offered, but it's a very complicated process, and students don't know necessarily one year to the next what the fees are going to be or how much of them might be covered by financial aid. And financial aid can be in grants, but it's also work study, and mostly in this day and age, it's loans. So there's this burden of a huge loan balance due once one receives a degree.
And I know that's something that everyone's looking at these days with great care. And UCLA is still considered one of the best institutions in the United States, and just this year received an unprecedented number of applications, over 90,000.
91,512, I believe.
There you go.
72,000 of those are for freshman admission, and the rest are for transfer students coming in as juniors. But it is, it's overwhelming, and I have no idea how one can fairly evaluate 91,000 applications. I'm very glad I've already received my degree. And I think one of the things that I love the most is I had no idea as a student that I would have this lifelong connection and involvement with the university. And it has meant far more to me, I think, as an alumni, even as a student. And I was a very active student. But there's this wonderful timeless quality of being connected to alumni who attended many years before me and helping select scholarship recipients who will be receiving degrees many years beyond me.
Yeah, certainly one of the things in doing all this research over the past several years that inspired me was learning about all the individuals who helped make UCLA the place that it is today. And having that appreciation of, you know, people like your great-grandfather and the namesakes behind the buildings and what they did and the battles that they fought to create UCLA and push it to be a better institution every day is just really inspiring. And I'm not sure that when I was a student I had that understanding. Did you, Anne?
Well, my parents had attended UCLA as well, and so I had a very strong attachment to UCLA from an early time in my life. And yes, everybody that I knew through my connections did have a connection to UCLA, and I think they appreciated being there. I don't know if they realized that that connection would continue or could continue many years beyond their degree. But I think the students, at least maybe this is just the way I like to remember it, that students did appreciate the opportunity to receive a degree at UCLA.
Yes. And talking with some of the Bruin Pioneers, which are our first UCLA students who attended the previous campus, which many people don't know about, on the Vermont Avenue near Hollywood, in Hollywood, they paid about $25 a semester to go to school. However, it would have been right after the stock market crash, and that was very difficult at that time as well.
Absolutely.
And they did whatever they had to do to get to go to UCLA because it was important to them. So
and
their
I know
stories, yeah.
my father was unable to continue and complete his degree because of the depression. He had to work. There was no way around it. And even though he later went on and was able to go to law school at night, he never really received his bachelor's degree. It was my mother who did, but her family was in better circumstances, and she was able to afford to go there. But it either ended or postponed a lot of students' histories at UCLA.
Now, in reading the book, of course, you were a member of the book committee that helped steer this project along. In reading the final book, is there something that surprised you about UCLA?
Well, first of all, what just amazes me is the incredible job that you did, because I know putting 8 years of research and somehow coming down to which stories go in and how much space each story is going to be allotted and choosing which pictures go where. I'm just in awe of this amazing book. And it just shows that you have such an obvious great affection for your subject as well. So my congratulations to you on a job very well done.
Thank you, Anne. It always makes it easy when you have a subject that's as interesting and, you know, wonderful as UCLA. And being an alum, that's something that's in my soul, really.
Oh, I can certainly see it in the wonderful book. It's interesting. One of the things that fascinated me the most, and something I did not know about at all as a student, is the internment of our Japanese-American students after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. This is not something that was ever taught in the history classes that I took in high school and college. Maybe I wasn't taking the right classes, but the Japanese-American community did not really talk about the internment once they came back for that part of that generation. And it wasn't until I was teaching school that I took a course and learned about I learned the details of the internment camps. And then once I just really appreciate that you've put this into the book with personal connections to how this affected our Japanese American community and the students that were involved. And I was so proud of UCLA to invite those students back, even though it was a long wait, to receive their degrees and get the recognition that they deserved.
Yes, and of course that was possible after the UC Regents lifted the moratorium on honorary degrees, and Chancellor Jean Block invited them to receive diplomas many years later, either the students themselves or representatives of their family. And that was a part of the book that was very important to me. I agree with you that it's a part of history that was very painful and often glossed over. And we took special effort to try to reach out to the community. And in fact, a local newspaper, the Rafu Shinpo, helped us reach out. And so we were able to interview several of those students and piece together a composite story from their perspective. And the truth is that UCLA administrators really tried to help these students get to other universities. But unfortunately, the times didn't allow that. And when the War Relocation Board was instituted, it really was out of their hands.
But we have to appreciate the efforts that our university administrators did make to at least try and ease that terrible pain. And even I do know, having talked with people since, of friends and colleagues of mine who were in UCLA as students during the war, and their personal connections to their Japanese American friends and their efforts to store their belongings for them and keep in touch with them and somehow maintain that relationship, even though they were no longer on campus.
Yes.
So, Marina, what do you think is the part of your favorite part of this book?
That's a difficult question because I do like so much of it. But to be honest, I think that your time at UCLA, the 60s, and particularly the early 60s, are one of my favorite because that was the time of Chancellor Franklin Murphy, who had come to UCLA previously as chancellor from the Kansas University.
University of Kansas, yes.
Yes, correct, sorry. And essentially helped develop UCLA's identity by pushing time and time again for decentralization from the headquarters of the University of California, and came up against Clark Kerr, and these are two titans of higher education, and really each of them doing what they thought was in the best interest of both the system and the campus. And in the end, achieving a result that really put UCLA toward the path that it is on now.
Oh, I agree completely. It's interesting, Franklin Murphy was my next-door neighbor's roommate as a student at the University of Kansas, so I have that extra connection to him. And one of the things that I also appreciated about Chancellor Murphy is that he really made an effort to highlight UCLA in the international world. And some of my fondest memories are the Charter Day events that would bring international figures to speak to us. I remember particularly when the presidents Johnson and then Mexican President Lopez Mateos appeared. We had this huge setup out on what was then the intramural field. And it was somewhat chilling because this, of course, was right after the President Kennedy's assassination. And as you sat out in the field looking across the campus, and you'd look from one building to the next, each building had sharpshooters poised on the top of the building watching to make sure the world was safe. And the two presidents arrived by helicopter to give their addresses and then left in the same fashion. So it was interesting to feel like you were such an important place in the world, but then again, you had the shadow of fear of what that could bring as well.
Yes, and that was one of his first key speech as billed by the White House after he took office. And the Secret Service also went to areas around UCLA and also into the dormitories, and all students had to leave their doors open and windows shut, and there was quite a lot of precaution, as you might expect in a situation like that. But still remarkable that a sitting president would come to campus at that time. And there have been many speakers at UCLA over the years. Martin Luther King.
And I suppose that's sort of highlighting what you were talking about before in terms of a university that was willing to take risks. Mm-hmm. So we knew this was important, and we didn't want to be ruled by fear. And I appreciate that. I also remember seeing Haile Selassie, who was the emperor of Ethiopia. And for some reason, that was in Pauley Pavilion at that time. And as he left the pavilion following his address, they played the march from the opera Aida, which was so inappropriate. It's a beautiful march, but if you have any idea of the story of the opera, it was not really the right theme for that moment. So there are always some interesting little humorous things that can happen.
All those anecdotes that make the life of the university, really. Okay, I'm told that we really do have a caller this time, not a chat. Let's see. Hello, are you there?
Hi. Hi, Anne. Hi, Marina.
Hello. Oh, hi. Hello.
Great show. I have a question. Are there any stories that you ran across while you were doing your research that you just thought, oh, no, I can't put that in the book?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I think mostly for space reasons. I don't think that there was anything that, you know, would have been too controversial. Let's see.
I don't know. Did you write about Red Sanders?
Talk about controversial. I did write about Red Sanders and his interesting champion. He was a football coach who led UCLA.
A very successful one.
Yes, who led UCLA to its first, and only national championship in football. And he died an untimely death in downtown. And, of course, everyone who's listening, you can go ahead and look up some of those details. I'll save that, Mark.
I have one more question. This is for you, Anne. Since you were on the committee that got the book started, did you give any direction to the author as far as things to avoid or what she should talk about, anything like that?
Well, you have to remember I come from having edited two UCLA yearbooks, and what I truly appreciated about that experience was no one ever told me what to do or what not to do, and I had complete control over the material that went into those volumes. And I felt that with Marina, she should have that choice as well, that it was up to her to decide how the story should be told and for her to choose the way to tell it. And I think that's the best way to come out with a successful book like this, because it wasn't put together by a committee. There was one writer and one editor. Obviously, there was lots of input that she could use that had been provided by the committee and others. But I think it's very important that the final decisions were made by Marina.
And I think that's what made it such more of a story and an authentic book, and not trying to squeeze in things that people were wed to just because there was personal connections or other issues. And I really tried to weave a story of UCLA as a whole, and that's why rather than a lot of individual profiles, everything is in the chronological narrative as the story of UCLA itself, the university, unfolded. So I was really appreciative of the committee's attitude in that respect.
Well, great. Thanks for taking my questions.
Sure.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, that brings a good point about how much more material could have been put into this book. But at 360 pages and with over 900 photographs, I think quite a lot of it was able to present itself there. And,
well, and
mentioned,
we really hadn't had any history of UCLA since UCLA on the Move, and that was in, I believe, 1967. So a lot has happened since then, and this needed to be documented. And, of course, your history project went far beyond just, I won't say just the publication of the book, because that was the ultimate goal. But we have now such a wonderful backlog of historical information and original documents, things that you've turned up that we had no idea existed. And so this is available for further research and further writings. It's just the beginning.
That's the great hope, really, that this will inspire many more discussions and projects on UCLA history. And really, I think that one of the challenges and one of the great interesting aspects of this work was to find out how much of UCLA's history was embedded in research all over the country. It wasn't just a matter of going to the UCLA Library, although a very rich resource. Also, we obtained materials from the National Archives on UCLA's very secret role on the Manhattan Project, which wasn't known until much more recently. And we were able to obtain those declassified documents, which pieced together this story. And that's something that I don't believe most people know still today. And also, we obtained information from Mississippi, from the New York Public Library, and it was really just shows how much UCLA has an impact across the United States and really in the world beyond it as well.
We have much to be proud of.
We do. Well, Anne, is there anything else that you'd like to mention? Anything else that particularly strikes you from your days at UCLA or from the book itself?
I think I've gone through pretty much all of the things that I was going to discuss. Of course, once this conversation ends, I'll think of others. But I think one of the things that is important is often the period of history that we know the least about is that which has preceded us by about 10 years. It hasn't made its way into the curriculum yet, but it's not something that we were aware of in our own appreciation of our current history. So that's what I appreciate about it. I mean, I didn't know much about the 50s, for example, at UCLA. And I think it's wonderful to have a complete view of our university all the way through, so you can learn about generations that perhaps did things quite differently.
Mm-hmm. And of course, UCLA's history continues to be created, and we are reaching a centennial in 2019. So everything so far has been accomplished in the span of less than 100 years, which is quite remarkable. It's the youngest institution to have risen so far so fast. In fact, I think that's one of the quotes that one of the previous chancellors had said. So the book, of course, is recently released, as I mentioned, and people can find it at the UCLA store, as well as independent bookstores throughout the West Side, including Book Soup and Diesel, Skylark, and Bowman's. And Anne, I would like to really thank you for being here. This was a delightful conversation. I really appreciate all your help and even learning a little bit more about UCLA from my talk with you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Marina. It's been my pleasure.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Anne. Until next time.
Yes.
Left you on a debris.